It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. For the first time in two decades, public opinion is shifting toward favoring more gun rights rather than gun restrictions. We'll get the details in just a bit.
First, according to a new audit, it may have been tough for the unemployed to connect with the state about claims thanks to blocked phone calls and understaffing.
The state's Legislative Audit Bureau reviewed information from the Department of Workforce Development because of concerns about the difficulty in trying to file a claim. They put all their information into a report released today.
Patty Murray is with us to talk about that report. She's a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News in Green Bay. Patty, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, this is a report into unemployment insurance claims in Wisconsin, the idea being that the worker and the employer both pay into that, and then you get back when you file an initial unemployment claim with the Department of Workforce Development. How do people usually file that initial claim?
Well, it's changing, Veronica. It changed in November drastically, but we can get to that. There are basically three ways. Historically, there have been three ways. You can either file online. There's an automated telephone system, or you can try to get through to one of the Department of Workforce Development's call center and talk to a claims specialist.
And so for a lot of people, apparently that system did not work. People weren't able to complete that claim process. How come?
Well, it was the sheer volume of calls, according to the chairs of the Legislative Audit Bureau Committee. I spoke to State Representative Kirkman, Samantha Kirkman. She's one of the co-chairs. And she said that normally in the winter there is a spike in claims because of, you know, seasonal employment. So in the winter, normally claims go up. Last winter was abnormally cold and snowy, and they just saw a huge, huge influx of claims and calls. And that's one of the things they're attributing it to. And there's also systemic improvements that need to be made.
Do we know roughly how many people had to use these call centers to finish those claims?
I don't know the exact number of people who call instead of going online. See, in November, this is what I was hinting at just now. In November, the DWD improved its online application system. Before, you could initiate your application online, but most people would not be able to complete it that way, and they would be routed through, they would be referred either to the automated number or to one of the call centers to talk to a claims specialist. But now, in November, they just improved the site so that you can begin and finish there for the most part. Most people would be able to go online, fill out your relevant information, and you would be able to get your process started that way.
So things are changing, but in terms of the findings of the report, do we know how many people had unanswered calls as they were trying to complete the process?
Well, the report is saying, and what's grabbing the headlines, is 1.7 million blocked or dropped calls. Well, the DWD is saying, and they're, you know, they want people to know that's not 1.7 million people. That's not 1.7 million cases. That's 1.7 million calls. You know, what do you do when you're on hold and you're waiting for your, you know, unemployment insurance benefits to come through? You know, you want to make that happen. It's a critical situation for most people. So you hang up, you call again. You hang up, you call again.
Now, I understand that some calls may have been unanswered, but the report uses the language blocked. Why would some calls be blocked altogether?
Because the automated system can't handle the volume.
I see. And so going forward, what sort of changes, a little bit more, do we know will be implemented, and how fast will that be on the ground?
Well, like I said, that the online site where you can start, take your case from start to finish online, that's going to be, the DWD is hoping that is going to relieve a lot of the stress on the phone system. They say that you know, a lot of people who, you know, you're a seasonal worker, maybe every December, January, you do file for unemployment, and you've done this for years. But, you know, they're used to using the phone system, and they're saying now they really want to direct that traffic to the online site, which is accessible at DWD.gov.
So we're heading into winter again, possibly another round of high volume time. So it sounds as though, predictably, that this may not be a problem this time. Is that what they're anticipating?
I think that's what they're hoping for. They're probably hoping for better weather, too.
Right. Well, moving on to some other points of interest in the report, recouping overpayments. Now, apparently sometimes the state pays too much in unemployment insurance. Do we know how much the state has overpaid in recent years?
Well, the report was showing it had overpaid by about $167 million.
So how much of that overpaid money has been recouped that we know of?
The report shows $143 million has been recouped, but that's leaving $24 million on the table. And the other co-chair of the audit committee is State Senator Robert Coles, and he found that unacceptable when I talked to him today.
And in terms of why this is happening, what do we know about why some people are overpaid? What is the bug in the system there?
You know, that was really interesting. If you read the report summary, most of the overpayments were unintentional when you're talking percentage-wise. Okay, you know, something like 60-some percent. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head. I'm sorry. They were unintentional, okay? And that amounted to like $62 million. That's a lot of money. But I guess people were confused by the system. They entered the wrong information for whatever reason. That was unintentional. Now, 10% of the overpayments, okay, so it's the smaller percentage of the overpayments, that accounted for $86 million. And that, the report says, was intentional misrepresentation. So it's a smaller number of people, smaller number of cases, larger amount of money.
What are the recommendations from the report?
Well, there is going to be a public hearing. It's not scheduled yet, but Senator Coles told me it could be, he hopes to see it as soon as January. So it'll get a, you know, good public airing there. And there is to be a report to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and that is required by March 16th. So we will be hearing about this through the winter and spring, I think.
Well, Patty, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it today.
Okay, hope it helped.
Thanks a lot. Patty Murray, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio in Green Bay. For the first time in two decades, a survey by the Pew Research Center shows that 52% of Americans say it's more important to protect gun ownership rights than to control access to guns.
The news comes on the heels of the Newtown school shooting anniversary, an event that sparked much public debate over gun rights and gun control.
Pew saw the biggest jump in support among African Americans. 54% now believe that guns are more likely to provide personal protection. Only 29% believed that 2 years ago.
And we're interested in hearing your thoughts in reaction to these numbers. You can call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Our guest today is Stan Stojkovich. He is the dean and professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
First, let me get your general reaction to the Pew's latest findings that for the first time in a few decades, there's a slight majority of Americans who favor protecting the right to own guns. What do you make of that?
Well, there's probably a lot of ways to interpret that. You know, a lot of it that is noted is, depending on how you ask that question of people, I would be a little bit suspect when you have such a huge swing. You know, especially with a subpopulation like African Americans going from 29% to 54% in a relatively short period of time, something else may be going on in terms of how they ask the questions. And I think those kinds of questions about the questions become more relevant. They're not relevant to people who are interested in the topic because they believe that the representation of, you know, gun control is one in which it's targeting all Americans. When really, in reality, gun control laws that have been passed really target criminals. They target people who are dangerous, who are potentially dangerous. And so they're not targeting the ordinary person who wants to have a gun for hunting or for shooting. They're targeting other kinds of people. So it's the types of questions that I get concerned about when you see these polls, particularly when you have huge swings in either support or non-support for an issue.
Well, and actually, now that you mention that, I recall reading that the poll was taken last week, I think, December 1st through the 7th or so. And I wonder how much of the swing in the opinion of African Americans has to do with recent developments across the country with regards to police-related deaths and that sort of thing, if owning a gun would make them feel more secure and able to protect themselves personally. Do you think that current events and sort of looking at when the survey was taken in context might explain this nearly doubled rating in terms of the statistics of African Americans?
That's a possibility. You know, time period is one that can affect causality. You know, when it happens, how it happens, how it's asked. But yet, having said that, I do believe that there has been a kernel of truth in the position that persons of color, particularly African Americans in inner cities of this country, do face much more dangerous conditions than people in other communities. And so from a rational perspective, it may be, from their point of view, okay to carry a weapon, you know, even if that weapon is illegally obtained, because they are in greater peril compared to other individuals. Now, I'm not here to advocate that position, that people should arm themselves, but I am here to say that there are some realities that people face, and I think that those realities are pressing on them, particularly now, when we've had a lot of backlash against the criminal justice system, most notably police behavior across the country. It's very much out there, obviously, in the media. People are literally out in the streets protesting about these issues and these events. So clearly that may have an impact that we were not foreseeing when we did the poll, and would influence, I think, the direction of what people say regarding their favoring or not favoring a particular issue.
And meanwhile, there are lingering public conversations about major events that have happened over the last few years. We're 2 years out of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. What, if any, impact did that singular event have on public opinion with regards to guns in America?
Well, I think these types of events, and, you know, we've had a spate of these events over the last 2 years in particular, where there have been mass shootings in schools and restaurants and public venues, you know, movie theaters out in Colorado, for example. I mean, those types of things do affect people's consciousness. Now, historically speaking, they're still relatively rare events. Nevertheless, it has an impact on some people's behavior. Now, having said that, in many states where, you know, for example, carry concealed laws, which are virtually in all 50 states now, there's like one or two states that do not have a carry concealed law. Most citizens who have a legal right to carry a weapon will never apply for the petition. In fact, we know that about 3 to 7% of the adult legal population who are eligible to carry or seek a permit never pursue it, largely because they have probably a notion about guns, and they may feel safe or unsafe about guns. But, you know, there still is a larger segment of people, it's not insignificant, who believe that this is obviously tied to the Second Amendment and historical kinds of issues, and that's a debatable point, of course. But my sense is that events do affect people. How they affect people is usually differential and varied. And it's the nuance that you have to really grasp when you start to interpret these polls.
We're talking with Stan Stojkovich. He's dean and professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're interested in your thoughts, too, as we talk about a Pew Research poll showing that for the first time in a couple of decades, the majority of Americans favor more legislation or lack thereof over gun rights rather than gun control. Do you agree with that opinion? If you were to have taken that survey, what might have you said in response? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. We did hear from Patrick on Facebook, who kind of echoes what you're saying, Stan, that he contends that the media have allowed the gun lobby to control the conversation. Gun control is not about normal people owning guns. It is about preventing guns from being used by the mentally ill and violently prone. It is the people in these groups that are killing us.
That's probably a fair statement. And remember, this has always been a controversial issue. 52% is a simple majority. You know, that means 48% have questions. So it's a controversial issue. It's complex. I don't expect in the near near distant future, I should say, unanimity around this issue. This is always raises, I think, complicated issues and responses. But I think what should come out of this is clarity about what the laws are really about. They are not, again, about preventing or precluding or stopping someone from having a legal right to a weapon that he or she can, you know, use either to protect themselves or for hunting or for whatever venue that they think it's appropriate to use that. But, you know, I think that the gun advocates are individuals who are concerned about, well, if they're doing these types of laws, they might jump to us, you know, legal people. And there is no evidence that that's necessarily the case and that anyone even has that interest. But, you know, this is a very controversial issue again, and the complexities have the devil's in the details, and we have to appreciate that when we seek understanding about the issue.
That's true. The polls seem to have drawn a mutually exclusive contrast between gun ownership and gun regulation or sales of regulation of gun sales, almost as if to say if you're in favor of regulating gun sales, then you must not be in favor at all. You must be totally opposed to personal gun ownership. I'm wondering if that's a faulty conclusion to draw, and if so, does that detract from the credibility of the Pew Research Center's findings?
Yeah, I think that these false dichotomies, you know, you're either with me or you're against me, you're either black or you're white, you're either Republican or a Democrat, these dichotomies, they're neat representations of a portion of reality that nobody lives in. And I think what we really need to understand is that, you know, life is lived in the gray. It's not black and white, it's gray. And there's a lot of complexity with the issues. And so I don't think that this contrastive view is helpful to anyone, because you could be a legitimate gun owner who's following the law, who believes that he or she has a right to carry that weapon. And, you know, under our law and our system, God love you, because that is the case. So and that doesn't mean that you're a crazy gun advocate either. Conversely, it doesn't mean that people who want some type of controls are anti-gun. Again, the nuances and the variances are really there. And I think what you're seeing when you see more of these shootings is people starting to recognize that and saying, let's be nuanced in how we write legislation then and how we develop public policy and what the public discourse and dialogue is about the issue. That, to me, would take it a lot further down the road and be much more helpful to society on the whole.
Let's take a call from Dan in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dan.
Hi. When this Second Amendment was put into existence, our forefathers were carrying muskets. If they had any idea that the type of weapons that would be available 200 years or thereabouts from then, I can't believe there'd be any way in the world that they would have instigated this Second Amendment.
The caller brings up a key point that, you know, people who are concerned about the availability of high-powered weapons in our society always bring up. And my response is, you know, that is an interpretation. And in our system of government, the Supreme Court ultimately makes the interpretation. And clearly, recent Supreme Court decisions about gun ownership have favored that old interpretation, that it really means an individual right, when for decades the Supreme Court never addressed that issue. But they now have in the last few years. And they said, you know, this is clearly something that is an individual response. I agree with the caller in terms of I don't agree with that interpretation. Nevertheless, I'm bound by the laws of the land. And the Supreme Court has stated that. So that's an ongoing conversation that ultimately I think we have to resolve in one way or the other. But again, recognizing you don't have to be a criminal to be, you know, to understand a person as a criminal is only the person who cares about gun rights or doesn't care about gun rights. I think we really have to ratchet up the conversation that allows us to really get more complexity and then, again, public policy around that. But I think that caller has a point of view that's shared by many.
And, of course, you don't have a crystal ball to go back a few centuries and try to figure that out, but a lot of people today make the claim that I feel more secure having a gun, or I need a gun in case something happens. I'm wondering if there's statistical data showing how many would-be crime victims prevented or even survived a crime because he or she was armed with a gun. Do we have numbers on that?
We do have some research on that, but it's very difficult research to conduct and also to interpret. Again, what's the meaning of that? We do know that the presence of a gun in a home increases the possibility of accidents, premature death, untimely death, especially through young people playing with guns. And we've heard of, you know, rare tragedies. They're not common, but they occur where that happens. So a gun's presence, in my sense, is not an empirical question. It's a social question at one level. In other words, if I'm walking around and I see someone has a gun, right, and they're not a police officer, I'm concerned and I'm asking questions about why they have that gun. And quite frankly, I walk away from them. Mm-hmm. I leave those people. I think a lot of people do that because they don't know what their motives are. They don't know why they have that gun. And there are a lot of people that are armed today. Obviously, most states, again, have carry concealed as an example. The reality is it changes the nature of social relationships, and that's a deep-seated question we need to investigate. That's an important question, it seems to me.
Well, Stan, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Have a great day.
That was Stan Stojkovic. He's dean and professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Last month, Wisconsin's Economic Development Corporation launched a new $1.6 million ad campaign to lure businesses to Wisconsin. They're advertising online, in print, and on the radio in neighboring states. Here's an example of one of the radio ads playing in Illinois.
12,000 years ago, during the late Pleistocene period, receding glaciers just north of Illinois created a unique climate called Wisconsin. While states to the south are generally characterized as flat, Wisconsin rises with economic possibility. A land shaped by fiscal responsibility and gentle, business-friendly tax policy, creating an environment ideally suited to business growth. Make a move to a healthier business environment and find out why Wisconsin at inwisconsin.com.
Since Governor Walker took office, one of his catchphrases has been, Wisconsin is open for business. Here's a clip of Governor Walker at the opening of his inaugural speech in 2011.
As your governor, I make this pledge. Wisconsin is open for business. We will work tirelessly to restore economic growth and vibrancy to our state. My top priorities are simple. Jobs, jobs, and more jobs.
Now, on a smaller scale, think about moving your home to a new state. There are probably a lot of logistics to be worked out. It takes time, energy, and money. Moving a business to a new state likely requires those same things.
So here's the question. Even if the environment for business looks good on paper with low corporate taxes, good infrastructure, and an educated workforce, is that enough to get businesses to make the move? Here to help us answer that question is Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Well, that ad we just heard and this new ad campaign in general, they target three aspects of Wisconsin that is being touted as being attractive to businesses, and that would be low corporate taxes, an educated workforce, good infrastructure. Can you fact check those for us now? What can you tell us about whether those hold water, those claims?
Well, they do. I mean, when you compare Wisconsin to some of our immediate neighbors, those generally are true statements, but my kind of take on this is, so what? One of the things that is kind of a bread and butter type of economic development strategy that's for the state and for a lot of communities in Wisconsin is to try to recruit businesses. And the problem is that businesses just simply don't move that much.
And why don't businesses move a lot?
Most businesses in Wisconsin are actually homegrown. They're here because this is where the business owner lived when they started the business. We did a survey of small rural manufacturers in Wisconsin and upper New England a number of years ago. And when I say small, I mean less than 100 employees. And someone wrote on the side of the survey and said, you find a community you want to live in, that's where you start your business. And that's what drives most business decisions.
In terms of how willing businesses are to move, you know, within Wisconsin and then over state lines, as this new ad campaign is hoping businesses will do, how willing are businesses to do that? What does it take to make that happen? You say it's rare. What does it take?
It really is more of an individual decision on the part of the business owner. There's examples of firms that have moved into Wisconsin. There's one example of a company that makes aftermarket parts for Harley-Davidson. And it was originally, the company was in Chicago, and they decided to move it out to the western part of the state. And the reason is because, well, the person is a Harley-Davidson fan, and he loves riding around in the Driftless area. It had nothing to do with taxes. It had nothing to do with education. It had to do with the fact that guy loved riding his Harley around the Driftless area.
So personal reasons again.
Exactly. There was a major company, Rayovac, in Madison here that was bought out by a company out of Atlanta, and they moved the corporate headquarters to Atlanta. You want to know why they moved the corporate headquarters to Atlanta? The CEO that owned the business or bought the business had a very nice house on a golf course on a lake outside of Atlanta, and he did not want to give that up.
Okay, so you're making the case that it's not going to be a climate friendly to business, but that can't hurt, can it?
No, it can't hurt, but there are, you know, $1.5 million on an advertising campaign to try to attract a small handful of businesses that move. I mean, we're putting the final touches on a study here, looking at firm movement in Wisconsin, and in 2011, the most recent year that we have, there's almost 500,000 businesses in Wisconsin, and only about 5,000 of those ever moved. And of those 5,000, the vast majority of them stayed in Wisconsin, and the vast majority of those moved less than 10 miles.
Are there particular kinds of companies that are more likely to move than others?
Not necessarily. There's a wide spectrum of firms that are moving around, but a lot of times it's essentially the reason that firms move is they start in one facility, and they grow and they outgrow the facility. And they simply decide, well, we have to move into it. We can't expand here, so we have to move down the street to a bigger facility.
Now, you're making the case that it's hard to get businesses to come over state lines from Illinois, from Minnesota, into Wisconsin. What about a business climate being unfriendly and drawing businesses, you know, causing them to move out of the state? Does that happen? And is that happening?
You can have situations where a community is not conducive to business development. We kind of use the phrase entrepreneurial community. It sounds kind of complicated, but it's really, is the community really a progressive community? I don't mean progressive in a political sense. I mean progressive in the sense that they're willing to try new ideas. They're willing to work together. They're willing to experiment. They're willing to learn from their mistakes. That kind of an entrepreneurial community, those are the kind of communities that will actually have a fairly positive business climate. An example of one that would not be, say a developer comes in and goes, I want to rebuild this storefront, or I want to rebuild this retail establishment. And the people behind the counter essentially say, well, here's a list of all the things you can't do. Go away. Okay. Now, that's not an entrepreneurial attitude. So it's really not so much the taxes. The workforce is somewhat important, but it's really kind of the attitude of the community.
You've studied business movement between the years 2000 and 2011. Now, Scott Walker entered office in 2011. At roughly the same time, Illinois raised its corporate income tax rate by 46%. So is there any reason to think that the numbers that we're talking about here, showing little movement, would have changed since that tax rate hike in Illinois in 2011?
I don't think there's going to be that much. I mean, you may get one or two firms that move, and those one or two firms are probably going to get coverage in the newspapers, but it's going to be a very, very small handful of firms. There was an example of a large pharmaceutical company in Illinois. It was an Indian company, and the CEO was an alumni of University of Chicago and wanted to locate in Illinois. But the fiscal situation in Illinois was so uncertain that they put it in Iowa. It had nothing to do with the tax rates. It had nothing to do with the labor force. It had to do with the fact that the Illinois fiscal house is in such terrible shape.
Now, some people who are dubious of this kind of ad campaign have said it might be better to nurture businesses that are in Wisconsin and not try to lure, say, businesses in Chicago, because really Chicago and Milwaukee are sort of one metro area anyway. What do you think about that critique?
That's actually a fair one. A lot of the businesses that have moved into Wisconsin have tended to move just over the border. Look at Stillwater and Hudson, Stillwater, Minnesota, and Hudson, Wisconsin. You see a number of firms that are jumping back and forth. But it's simply, again, it's that within that 5-mile, 10-mile radius, they just happen to find a better facility on the other side of the state line.
And we just heard that ad coming into the interview, one of the new ads from the campaign. Hearing that, if you're a business owner, you're close to the border here in Wisconsin, is that going to sway you at all?
If I was a business owner, no, it wouldn't at all.
Anything that would?
No, because I'm really looking at what is going to make my business the most profitable. And while we say things like taxes are important, in the bigger scheme of things, they're really actually quite small.
Well, we're speaking right now with Steve Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison, about whether out-of-state companies are being lured to Wisconsin. Governor Walker has marketed the state as attractive for business since he entered the office, and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is spending millions of dollars on ad campaigns trying to get companies to move here to Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a business owner? Are there policies that would lure you from one state to another? Consider the investment that moving requires. How big would the benefit have to be in order to do so? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org.
We're back with Steve Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. We're talking about whether state companies are actually moving to Wisconsin based on the lure of a better business climate. Now, Governor Walker has marketed the state as attractive for business since he entered office, and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is spending millions of dollars on ad campaigns to try to get companies to move here. This is an ad from that campaign.
12,000 years ago, during the late Pleistocene period, receding glaciers just north of Illinois created a unique climate called Wisconsin. While states to the south are generally characterized as flat, Wisconsin rises with economic possibility. A land shaped by fiscal responsibility and gentle, business-friendly tax policy, creating an environment ideally suited to business growth. Make a move to a healthier business environment and find out why Wisconsin at inwisconsin.com.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What do you make of ads like these? What would it take for you to lure your business to another state? 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org.
We're going to go right to our phones now and take a call from Thomas in Madison. Hi, Thomas.
Yes. Can you hear me okay? I'm sorry, my phone might be a little...
You're coming through pretty clear. I think we got you.
Okay. Yes, I'm an independent business owner. I have a new patented product that helps with fuel supplement systems with a hydrogen generator. It's a new design. I was looking to put down roots in Madison for the last year while we finished the product, but I've recently found a better deal in Youngstown, Ohio, and this is mainly because of several factors. The conservatives in Wisconsin State have been allowing illegal taxi companies, which are kind of competitive with the product I'm trying to market, companies like Uber and Lyft. I know this also has to do with a lot of non-conservatives in the Madison area, too, who support these companies. But then also, as far as incentives go, for a new product development and marketing, I've found a much better deal in Ohio. I just haven't seen any of these incentives that Walker is talking about. It's basically all talk. And then when I look at the taxes, the new product, and, of course, I'm marketing a new fuel product, essentially, and that's at odds with the conservative front.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing your experience there with us, Thomas. Thomas saying he's not seeing the perks that we're hearing about, that Wisconsin is friendly for businesses in terms of taxes, workforce, and infrastructure. He was lured away to Ohio. What do you make of that story?
Well, I mean, you will always find individual exceptions to the general rule. I mean, for example, you know, the half a million businesses that are in Wisconsin, I mean, there are about 5,000, 6,000 that do move in and out of the state. But, you know, in terms of percentages, it's a very small percent. I will say one thing, though, in terms of the incentives, is that this is something that Wisconsin has not gotten into, is these high-stake incentive games to try to recruit businesses. You know, the classic is South Carolina going after BMW or Alabama going after Mercedes. I mean, some of the incentives get to be so big that it's they'll never pay for themselves. I'm glad Wisconsin does not play that game.
As far as the motivation of an ad campaign like this and getting, you know, businesses to try to move from other states, is there motivation for the appearance of a good, people moving here looking better in the media versus, you know, what it might look like if businesses grew that were already here? Does one get a better headline?
I think that's one of the frustrations, is that when a business does move in, it tends to draw media attention. If you have 10 businesses, each one with 5 employees, and the state or local agency works with those 10 businesses and helps them grow and, say, doubles their employment, so there's 50 new jobs, or you have a business that moves in from Chicago that has 50 jobs, which one gets the media attention? Which one gets in the newspaper? It's the one that gets recruited. And I'm talking generally here, but, you know, politicians like to get that kind of attention. So there's an incentive to try to go whale hunting and hit that whale, because that will draw lots of attention. Whereas getting, you know, those smaller businesses that are homegrown and helping those smaller businesses that are will grow, you won't see that. It's kind of in the mix, and it won't come out.
Harder to talk about. Okay, well, thank you for that call, Thomas, and we'll go next to Tatiana in Spring Green. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi. It seems to me like they're trying to kind of dumb down the children with taking away some of our public education money and deregulating things, and I think we should use the talent that we have here, which is pretty unique, along with the lands that we have. My backyard, sometimes I watch The Lord of the Rings or whatever, and I look at it and I think, this could be filmed in my backyard. Why are we not bringing the film industry in here and using our local acting talent, like from American Players Theater and some of the other places? We could be involving the writers and filmmakers and really creative people that are here, and use, instead of destroying the land that we have, using the beautiful things that we have, like the seasons and the valleys and the rocks and the rivers and streams.
Okay,
and,
I understand. Thank you, Tatiana, for sharing that with us. And one of the things I think Tatiana was getting there is Wisconsin friendly to the so-called creative class?
I think it is. We generally think of Wisconsin as cold and snowy and people don't want to live here. And it's actually, rather than looking at the weather as a liability, we should be thinking of it as an asset and promoting it as a winter wonderland. And there's actually been some success in the very northern part of the state of trying to turn the thinking around and trying to promote what's called boomerang migrations. Local folks that have gone off to college, gone off, established a career, and then try to lure them back. And the way you lure them back is say, look at all the great winter recreation we have here.
That would have played well last winter for sure.
Yes,
it would. Well,
I'm not
winter.
Sure about the cold, but the snow, yes.
Right. All right. Well, let's thank you for that call, Tatiana. One last quick call from Jeff in Janesville. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I am a business owner. I have a company in a division in Wisconsin that we opened 2 years ago. We've had a division in Colorado that we have had for almost 5 years now. We absolutely look at the differences between the two states when we are making decisions about growth, and it's one of the reasons that we opened a facility in the state of Wisconsin. Yes, taxes are not the only thing. There are a lot of factors that come into it, certainly the overall business climate that Governor Walker is trying to put in place by saying we are friendly to business is something that we see. I also have a friend who owns a company in Illinois. He's been in Illinois for over 20 years. He is currently in the process of looking for land to move his company north of the border for the same reason. He sees a better business climate up here in Wisconsin than he sees in the state of Illinois.
And so, Jeff, real quickly, do you think that an ad campaign like the one we heard would help get the word out about what you consider a business-friendly climate here in Wisconsin?
I think it definitely would. Most people think there's not a lot of differences between communities or counties or states when it comes to, you know, the types of advantage, opportunities, and support that you get.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Appreciate your comments, and thank you for sharing that with us. Stephen, Republicans in Wisconsin's legislature have said they plan to take up right-to-work legislation at the start of the coming session, which starts in a couple of weeks. Now, one of the arguments usually made for that kind of legislation by supporters of the legislation is that it makes states more competitive. Now, do you think that passing right-to-work would do anything to encourage businesses to relocate to Wisconsin?
Yes and no. Like any good economist, it depends. If the idea is to draw in and promote lower-paying manufacturing jobs, then yes, right-to-work has proven to be somewhat effective. If the goal is to bring in higher wage professional-type jobs, then right-to-work doesn't really do anything. Right-to-work is really not an economic development strategy. It's really more of a philosophical argument about whether or not people should be forced to join a union if they don't want to. I think that, you know, trying to sell it as an economic development strategy, there just isn't the evidence to support that.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison.
Yesterday, we talked about the so-called super coffee that's high in saturated fat. It's made by blending together black coffee, grass-fed butter, and coconut oil.
And supposed to help you lose weight, achieve peak mental performance, too. Jimmy Fallon tries it. He likes it. And we asked you if you'd ever try it, and it sparked a bit of a discussion over on the Central Time Facebook page.
A listener named Anne writes, I might try it, but I wouldn't make a habit of squandering a quarter of the calories that I probably consume in a day on something with no protein, no vegetables, and very few, if any, vitamins and minerals.
Megan says she's tried it. She says it's delicious. She writes, it's definitely an energy boost and not something I do every day. Once in a while, though, it's a tasty treat.
And finally, John says he's tried it. And while he liked its taste and consistency, his wife actually forbids him to have any more of it, saying it isn't good for him.
Well, the New York Times reports that super coffee is actually taken off in Milwaukee, if you can believe this, along with Los Angeles and San Francisco and Milwaukee. That's another hot spot for super coffee. So if you're a super coffee drinker, maybe in Milwaukee, tell us about your experiences. You can keep that conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.